Thank you all for coming. Thank you and welcome back to these lectures. So this is lecture 3 in English, and we'll have the fourth one on Friday, same time. So today I will talk about, for about an hour, mostly I will talk about bacteria, prokaryotic organisms, and what makes them different from what I described last time about, in particular, sperm cells. What is their locomotion powered slightly differently, and what the consequences are for the cell, and what are all the things we can do from a mechanics standpoint and fluid mechanics standpoint to try and understand bacteria. So last time I remind you that I showed you this drawing, showing you approximately relative scale of different organisms, different model organisms that people have used to study locomotion. And today I will talk about the smallest ones, bacteria, one bacterium, multiple bacteria. And I've also showed you this last time to remind you for a second that the bacteria we're going to study are all propelled by something we call flagellar filaments. These are essentially passive, even though I want to talk about some compliance later in this talk. Filaments, which have the shape of a helix, a rigid helix, and they are rotated by a motor. And there is something called the hook. We'll talk about the hook, and the hook flexibility is very important for some processes, which transmits the rotation of the motor, which is fixed in the frame of the cell body, into a rotation of a flagellar filament, and the hook, it does this transmission. Now, there's already, you can see that there's an interesting thing that happens. If the hook is very floppy, very flexible, then you could ask the question of what sets the direction of the axis of each of those helices. I drew them right here with an axis right here going up right, horizontal, then this one going down. But we have to kind of solve for this in a systematic fashion. If this blue is very, very floppy, it should not give a lot of resistance to figuring out the rotation, the location of the flagellar filaments. And so we have to think of balancing all the forces on the cell as a whole. This is also a slide I think I showed last time. Even though we're going to talk about E. coli, which is this model organism with flagellar filaments that are sticking out at random points, essentially random. It's been measured. It's essentially random. It is a small, small bias front back from where basically remnant from cell division. But otherwise, it's essentially random. Multiple flagellar filaments sticking out. In other words, the motors are distributed essentially randomly. Other distributions exist. You can have one motor that is at the pole of the cell. You can have multiple motors all at the pole of the cell. You can have motors in the front and the back. There are invent cells. I'm not going to talk about them today, but they're very interesting cells called spirochetes, where the flagellar filament, the shape of the cell is helical. And in fact, the shape of the cell is inherited from the helical shape of the flagellar filament because the flagellar filament is, in fact, encased. You cannot see it because it is inside. So there's sort of a membrane around the filament, and that's what gives the cell body its shape. But of course, from the outside, it looks like it doesn't have a flagellum, but it has one, and it's inside, and the deformation of the flagellum through the motor gives rise to the locomotion of the cell. Now, from a mechanical, fluid mechanics standpoint, in the 70s, this was kind of figured out, all of this was figured out in the 70s, both from a biological and biophysics point of view and fluid mechanics. There has been some studies which consider organisms which use three-dimensional helical type motion. There were basically two types of studies. There are studies that assume that this helix, this is a perfect helix. Of course, you have to kind of bring the helix to zero right here. So the amplitude of the helix is constant, and then you add some sort of decaying envelope to bring it to a particular fixed point on the cell body. But basically, you can make a model where you imagine that this is a rigid corkscrew, and you just rotate this corkscrew, and it gives rise to locomotion. Now, you can do that from the point of view of fluid mechanics. It is exactly the same locomotion that you would get if, instead of having a rigid thing that would be rotated, literally like a corkscrew that you just rotate from one side, you would have a helical flexible wave that would propagate down, just similar to what a flagellum from a spermatozoan is doing, up and down and up and down. We just added a three-dimensionality. From the point of view of the external fluid mechanics, it's exactly the same thing. To within a very small amount, it's exactly the same thing. So it's very hard to distinguish this mode of locomotion, passive rotation to active waving. And so it basically would have to, it required kind of looking down on very, very small scale to be able to distinguish one from the other. And this was done for many people in the early 70s, but there's a paper, the very classical paper in Nature, that actually showed that indeed it is this mode of locomotion, that it is the relative rotation between a passive organelle and a passive cell body, and it's just the actuation is really just focused at the intersection between one and the other, and is not an active deformation. Okay, so I refer you to this classical paper that showed this in quite nice detail. And to show this, they've used the fact, and it's really a nice paper. It's actually about a page and a half, so, and it's very simply written. It's a really nice paper. To show this, they've actually used the fact that what you see in an experiment is not one filament, but it's multiple filaments. And they're all kind of gathered together in a bundle, an assembly of helical filaments. And it's by inspecting how one filament moves relative to the other that you can figure out which mode of rotation it is. So it's kind of a geometrical argument almost that they use in this paper. It's a very nice paper. So today we'll tell you about some of the external physics of locomotion of bacteria. And obviously there's a lot of internal, this is only, a part of the problem. There's a lot of biology and biophysics about understanding how the motor, each of those rotary motor works, and how the chemical network of signaling inside the cell basically makes the kind of the relationship between the input that the cell is what the cell is sensing from its environment, and how it decides to, in a chemical sense, not in a brain sense, but in a chemical sense, to change the way the motor rotates, and therefore to take decision from a cell point of view. Okay, I'm going to talk about only this, but underlying all of this is a lot of more complex biophysics and biology and biochemistry, and I'm not an expert in any of this. Okay, I can talk about this red box. That's it. Now, the motor that rotates the flagellar filament relative to the cell body has been studied for many years, trying to understand the characteristics of this motor, purely given as a piece of engine that provides a torque. So it turns out there are multiple methods that have been used, and the one that has been the most kind of flexible has been basically consisted on gluing a cell body to a surface, removing the flagellum, and then attaching a bead to the hook. Now, if the motor is rotating the hook, that means the bead will rotate, but because you can change the size of the bead, you can change very easily, well, easily, it's easy for me to say, probably very hard for them, but you know, in theory, it's easy to change the resistance, because we know exactly the resistance to rotating a bead of radius r goes like the cube of the size of the bead, so therefore you just vary the size, you vary the load, and therefore you can vary, you can kind of sweep all the possible torques that the motor can develop. And it turns out this motor works essentially at constant torque up to, so this is a torque versus speed, speed relationship of the motor, this is in hertz, this is in piconewton nanometer. It works at essentially constant torque, and then there is a kind of a critical speed at which the torque decays all the way to zero, and this is the maximum intrinsic speed of this motor. Now, there's a lot of error bars on those measurements that if you go back in the literature and look at what for E. coli is the value of the motor torque, there have been a lot of studies, a lot of experiments, and some numerical simulations, and there's kind of disagreement about a factor of 10. Smallest one being 370, the piconewton nanometer, and then Berg 1997 over 4,000, so about an order of magnitude. So recently we've done a study with a former postdoc of mine where we're trying to find an experiment. Many of those experiments involve multiple flagellar filaments, and they are very hard to get accurate kind of predictions. And so we actually we found an experiment from the Brook of Howard Berg. We were able to remove all but one of the singular flagellar filament from a cell, and the cell body was tethered to a surface, and so you know, roughly speaking, this is what it looks like, this is what the cell looks like, and you know, roughly speaking, what the distance, because the cell has a body has a given size and is glued to the surface, essentially you know the entire geometrical conformation, because they can observe rotation, they know everything, we know everything about the geometry, and we can observe all the rotation. We can then use accurate kind of Stokes flow type calculation to infer what the torque has to be in order for this rotation to occur. And it depends critically on the distance and kind of the angle that this axis of this helical axis makes with the horizontal. But it's according to our simulation, it's within the factor of 2, it's between 400 and 800 in that unit system. Now, to think about how do we solve for locomotion of the cell, it's not a very complicated problem. Let's imagine that the locomotion only occurs in one direction. I will show you in a minute or in a few minutes how it's not actually in 1D, but let's imagine for a moment that it's 1D. Well, if this is rigid and it's going to move like a rigid body, it's going to translate and rotate. This is a scalar function. I don't know what that speed is, but it exists. And I don't know what big omega is, but it's something. It's a rigid body, rotation around that axis. Now, this is also rigid, so this also translates and rotates. Because they're glued together, it has to translate at the same speed. And because they're undergoing relative rotation, I'm going to allow relative rotation, so that one moves with big omega, and that one moves with big omega plus little omega. That's my relative rotation. It's either prescribed, if you prescribe the rotation, or it's whatever you have to have in order to have a prescribed torque, either way, one of the other, but let's say it's prescribed for the time being. Now I have two unknowns. Little omega is prescribed, so I don't know what big omega is, and U, so I need two equations, and obviously I need to balance forces, I need to balance moment along the axis. So to do this, I need to characterize the hydrodynamics of a helix. Now this is an interesting problem, though this is going to be a 5-minute hydrodynamic aside. If you really do not like hydrodynamics, you're not going to like the next 5 minutes, so just bear with me. Well, it's not really hydrodynamics, it's kind of simple mechanics, let's say. So imagine I have a helix. It's basically, of course, the helix exists on a cube, so that radius of that cube is going to be big R. Lambda is the wavelength, and I'm going to call the tangent angle that the local tangent makes with the axis of the helix, theta. It's a kind of standard notation. Theta is counted to be positive if the helix is left-handed, and it's negative if the helix is right-handed. That's all standard notation. Now, last time I've convinced you, hopefully, that for rigid bodies, I have a linear relationship between force, in this case, the rigid body is a helix, the force and the torque in a fluid if the thing moves with a particular speed and a particular angular velocity. Okay, for the time being, I'm going to call the angular velocity of the helix big omega, and then later on, when I solve the full problem, I'll do this correctly. Okay, so U and omega, linearly related to F and the torque. There's a minus sign, and you know that this is my resistance matrix, which is positive definite, and there are four components. Now, A is the drag. If I translate with speed U, I'll get a force, so that's the drag. It's the same as the Stokes drag, not particularly thrilling. D is the drag in rotation, A is the drag in translation, okay, that's no big deal. B is the more interesting bit, because B couples omega to a force. So B, if there's a non-zero B, it means that if I rotate the object, it will actually feel a force along the axis. If the shape is very symmetric, it's not going to happen. If I give you a sphere, if I rotate the sphere, it's not going to feel a force either way by symmetry. So the shape has to have some broken symmetries, and in general, all shapes which are chiral, which are not the same, which break mirror image symmetries like a helix, gives you a non-trivial value of B. Now to calculate B, we can go back to things that I've spent some time discussing last time. If I look at a very, very slender filament, I can describe the filament is moving. At every point along the filament, I know the kinematics, the deformation relative to the fluid, and I can relate this linearly with the density, hydrodynamic force density that is exerted from the fluid on the filament. And there are two parameters that characterize this, which are my drag coefficient. One is the perpendicular one, and one in the parallel one, and I explained the origin of this in the last lectures. So if I look at, if I zoom in on my piece of my helix right here in the front, if I'm calling x the axis along the helix and y perpendicular, and my tangent, unit tangent t, this is the unit tangent vector t, is oriented by an angle theta, as I described a minute ago, then I can resolve this. Very easy to just calculate this component by component. And I get indeed a non-zero component of the force along x. That's the one we calculated last time. We used this to interpret propulsion last time. So now I need to build this, to use this to calculate elements of my matrix. Okay, so we can calculate two of them. I'm going to calculate B and D, and then I'll leave you to do A as homework. So let's calculate the B component. So the B component, I need to have a rotation, and I need to calculate how much force I get from a rotation. If I have a rotation which is an omega rotation, then that means that at this point right here, which is in the foreground of my helix, I will have an instantaneous velocity which is coming down, because the helix is rotating like this, so points that are close to me are coming down, and the points in the background are coming up. And this, of course, this speed is instantaneously, well, minus, because it's coming down, and then the radius of my helix times the angular velocity, very easy. So I know what U is, and I told you what the components of the force are, and so therefore I can calculate the total force. The total force is simply the force density, which is the force per unit length times the length. So it's just this formula, where I replaced U by minus omega R, and I added the entire length of the filament, because I need to integrate this over the entire helix. At every point on the helix is the same by symmetry, so therefore I know exactly what B is. See, the force is related to omega, and that coefficient right here is B. This is my B. We just calculated B. The pitch of the helix is hidden in theta, absolutely. It's hidden right here. Now, to calculate the torque, well, it's the same thing. If I have a rotation, it's the same kinematics, but the torque now is the moment arm of my force, so not of the force proportion along the axis of the helix, but the force perpendicular, that's the resistive force. So it's the moment arm, R, times the force density with a minus sign, because it's the force coming down, and I add all the contributions of the torque all the way along the x, and I multiply by L. So that means that I have this term, and that term is my D. So if I divide this by omega, this is my D term. Now my symmetry, by flipping theta to pi over 2 minus theta, you can do this at home and convince yourself that this is the value of F if you have translation. So that's the drag from translation. That's easy enough to do. That's the simplest one almost. Okay, so I have now built my matrix. I know everything. One thing that's interesting about, okay, this just went black. So one thing that's interesting about this matrix is to look at its is look at the sign. Let's look at the sign of B for a second. So A is positive, we know. D is positive, we know, because I convinced you hopefully last time that this matrix has to be definite positive, and so the term on the diagonal has to have to be positives. Now the matrix B can flip its sign. So clearly the drag perpendicular is above the drag parallel, so that's positive. R, L are positive, but of course you can change the angle, and that would change the sign of B. Okay, so if you go from a right-handed helix to a left-handed helix, you're going to change the direction of the propulsion. Now, for left-handed helix, theta is positive, so that means that this whole thing is positive. And that means the consequence is that if I stand behind the helix right here on the left, looking down on the helix, and I rotate omega in a counterclockwise sense, so from a trigonometric standpoint, in a positive, my force that I would get, because there's a minus sign, will be positive. I will get a propulsion in the x direction. So that means that if I have a left-handed helix, and if I look from the back, it looks like counterclockwise, then it will actually move forward. Okay, so it's important because it tells you which direction the cell is going. All right, now we can solve for the whole cell. It's very easy to do this. For the helix, I have force and torque related with those matrices that we just built, A, B, and D, with what the helix is doing. It's translating and it's rotating with this. Remind you, there's both the cell body rotation plus the relative rotation. And the body does the same. The resistance for the body is very boring. If the body is very symmetric, like a sphere or a rod or some kind of prolate spheroid, then basically I only have to calculate those two numbers. Drag from translation, drag from rotation. We can just do this. We have formula. We can do anything. Just assume we know them, okay? And we know in particular, I'll come back to this in a minute, how they scale with the size of the body. In particular, that scales like the first power of the size. This scales like the third power. So the entire cell has to be force and torque free, and so this plus that have to add up to zero. That's simple enough, and that's a linear system we can solve for. If I put all the terms with little omega on the right, then that's a simple system to invert. Now, I will come to this in a minute. That matrix is never singular, so therefore you can always solve this problem, and you have a nice solution. We haven't made, beyond this, we haven't made further approximations. U is some function linear times omega, so it's linear in omega, and big omega is also linear in little omega. Now, an interesting math aside, that if I write for my helix the relationship between force, torque, and kinematics, and for the body, or for the whole thing as well, those resistance matrices, which are minus times a matrix, that matrix is definite positive. It's symmetric, it's definite positive, it has two positive eigenvalues, so that means that its determinant has to be positive. If its determinant is positive, then I better have AD minus B squared is strictly positive. Okay? That's true for any resistance matrix of any rigid body. And same thing for this one. This is the resistance, the instantaneous resistance matrix of the whole thing. Therefore, it better be that A plus A naught times D plus D naught minus B squared is also strictly positive. It sounds perhaps not interesting that I'm telling you this. Why would you tell me this now? We're going to use this in a minute. So we're going to use this now to actually say something about the signs, this formula. Without having to actually really calculate anything, we can say things about the sign. So see, I told you those two terms are positives. And those terms turned out that, well, they show up on the denominator of those three formula. So we know that the denominator is negative, negative, positive. Now, what can we say about the sign? So we know, because we can see that in an experiment, that omega is negative. So the omega is negative. So that means that, well, B is positive, D naught is positive, the numerator here is negative, so it's this is also negative, so therefore the whole thing will be positive, the cell is actually going to move along the plus x direction. Omega, in that case, you can convince yourself very easily that the big omega, it will be positive, so the cell will counter-rotate. And in the lab frame, what you measure is not little omega, it's actually the sum of the rigid body rotation of the whole cell plus the relative rotation. That's the one that you observe in the frame of the lab, and that will always be negative. So what you see in the lab, what you see in the lab are those three things. You're going to see U positive, you're going to see the cell moving forward to the right. You're going to see omega plus little omega, the perceived rotation of the flagellum in the frame of the lab going negative, so it's going counterclockwise, and you're going to see the cell body rotating the other way clockwise. So you're balancing moments, and this is what leads to this rotation, and you're balancing force, which gives rise to the translation. Yes. So the rotation speed typically would be on the order of about 100 hertz, I would say, for the little omega. That's a good question. In fact, I could go back to this for a second and show you this plot. So see, the speed scale is on the order of hundreds of hertz. Okay, so Y-type equal I, you would measure 100, 150 hertz. And then if you measure, so that's the high-speed rotation of the flagellum. The cell body is big, so it's actually, because it has high resistance, it needs to rotate less, so it's about an order of magnitude. So typically 10 hertz would be the angular velocity of the cell body. Here? Well, they change, well, the experiment that I, they don't change the rotation. They can't go and change the rotation. What they can change is the load. And we know that if I change the load, it's going to affect, so basically, it's kind of a multiple-step experiment where you measure a new rotation, and you know what the load is, so that gives you what the torque is, and it gives you the rotation, and you change the load, and you see what the system is doing. That's how they've done it. Yeah. And there, by the way, the one that I've described here is the one that a lot of people describe and have used because it gives you so much flexibility of doing the load. If you have, you know, if the experiment is easy to build and you have multiple colloids and you know exactly their size, then it gives you a lot of, but there are all the ways that people have done it. They've done rotation, they've tethered the cell instead of tethering the cell body, they tether the flagellum or the hook itself, and then they have one data point because the cell body is whatever it is. So there are all the ways that people have done this. Now, this was the 1D picture of locomotion. It's very elementary. Of course, you have to know hydrodynamics to be able to calculate really all the prefactors of all these things and make sure that it agrees. So if you do all the calculations correctly, you will get that indeed this is about an order of magnitude in size larger than this one, and that's about 20, 30 microns per second in terms of the speed. Now, real life is not one-dimensional, it's three-dimensional. The flagellar axis is not going to be exactly aligned with the cell body. There could be multiple flagella sticking out at different angles. And so in real life, this instantaneous balance of force and moment is now a vector equation. So you have to do this with all degrees of freedom. You have to be careful when you balance torques to make sure you balance them all at the same point. It's kind of becomes a bit complicated. But basically, in real life, you don't get one-dimensional unidirectional motion, you get helices. So in general, you will get some sort of instantaneous value of U, some instantaneous value of omega. Those two things are not going to be aligned exactly with one another. And so in general, if you have a constant U and a constant omega, then your rigid body is going to do a helix, kind of a classical thing. And there's a surprising huge amount of variability. This is a population of a single cell. I forgot to write the name of the bacteria, my apologies, from the studies. And even if you were to take cells which came from a single cell line, just divide, they're all identical, there's a huge variation. This is the statistical distribution of a few thousand organisms on the pitch of the helical trajectory now, not the shape of the helix, they're all the same helix, all the same everything, the trajectory. And you can see that there are some that have very small wiggles, there are some that are more straight, and so huge variation on the pitch and the radius of the helix. Okay, but in general, at least kind of when you think about the physics, it's the same idea. It's balancing force, balancing moments, and then you get a helix instead of getting a straight line. Now, an interesting thing for bacteria that is not happening for the active flagellar filaments that I mentioned for the spermatozoa and eukaryotes is that those flagellar filaments, I told you they're a rigid helix. It's not quite right. They exist in multiple shapes. So if I look at a wild-type E. coli, as it swims in its swimming phase, it will have one shape. And that shape is called the normal shape. But if you were to extract this flagellar filament and apply a perturbation, a chemical perturbation or physical, you torque it, you pull it, change the temperature, change the pH, you can make a snap into other conformations. And the shapes, those shapes were predicted from theory and from the 70s. They were predicted to be 12 of them. And that's because this polymer, this is a single polymer, it's called, the monomer is called flagellin. This flagellin exists in two conformations. And the flagellar filament is made of multiple filaments of this same polymer, protofilaments. And those filaments all have to be in the same conformation, but they don't have to be in the same conformation at the neighbor. So if you actually look at, I'm not an expert on this, but basically from a stability, biochemical stability, there's only, in theory, there should be only 12 possible shapes that exist. It's a little bit like playing Lego. If I give you blue pieces and I give you red pieces, they don't all quite fit to one another. There's only so many things. There's only so many Star Wars ships you can build with those pieces of Legos. And that's basically what it is, okay, from a stability standpoint. Now, those 12 shapes, two of them are straight line. If it's all one type or all the other, and then there are actually 10 helices. Out of those 12 shapes, 9 of them have been observed experimentally to agree very nicely with the theory. The majority of them are right-handed helix. Okay, so you would take a helix, left-handed, and you will pull. It will deform elastically, but it will, roughly speaking, would like to remain like it is. You just have some small deformation. And then after some critical deformation, it will snap to a different shape. Okay, people have studied this physically. I refer you to this beautiful paper from Nick Darrington and Howard Berg showing those transitions. It's really wonderful what they're able to do. So those shapes are mostly all right-handed. And three of them are left-handed. And the one that is used for swimming is this left-handed one called the normal shape. One that is used also for changing direction is called this one, called semicoid. A few of them have been given names because we see them in other contexts. No, I do not. I'm sorry. So you mean if you change the chirality?
Yeah.
That's right. So, but it's...
More than that.
Well, yes. So it's more than that in a sense that this is like a potential with different whales. So you're at the moment, if I'm in the normal shape, I'm near the bottom of a whale for this particular shape, but there's another equilibrium that exists. For if I pull on it, I will be able to jump over. I don't have a kind of a mechanical answer to this. What I do is mechanics. So all I can tell you is that I can see what they observed. Yes, I will tell you in a minute. Well, it's cases where that happens, yes. So here's an example of how you can get this shape. So you grab on a cell and you remove the flagellar filament and then you attach it to a post and then you flow uniform flow past it. These are very old studies, very influential because they're able to visualize the flagellar filament, which something had not been done, for another 20 years. And you can see domains which propagate between one type of flagellar filament with one. This one is long wavelength, and this one is a short wavelength, and you can see this transition. So this domain is propagating all the way down, and then you nucleate another one. So this is long wavelength, and then suddenly, boom, the short wavelength comes back. So you get the cyclic transformation of domains, which is kind of like this experiment I described, except in this case, the forcing is due to the shear forces from the flow. And then the system, if you shear it just right where it at the transition regime, then you keep having one versus the other. Okay, very interesting. Bistability in this case for two shapes. So an interesting question that we asked a couple years ago is to say, well, what's the efficiency of the cell when it swims? So I remind you, these are the problems that we solve. We can define an efficiency from a swimming point of view, which will be the ratio of two energies, two rate of energy, two powers. One is the power that I need to move the thing that I want to transport, which is my cell, at speed u. So the force that I need to move this cell at speed u is a naught times u. So therefore, the power, the rate at which I need to do work, the rate at which I lose energy per unit time is simply a naught u squared. That's the useful power that I need to transport whatever is in the cell at that speed. And I can divide this by what I'm expending. What the cell is actually expending is the energy that is spent by the motor. So it's the rate at which the motor is doing work. So it's the torque of the motor times the relative rotation between the motor, between the flagellar filament and the cell body. So that's a dimensionless number. You can calculate this. This is what it is. Now, what's interesting about this efficiency is that the cell body is set by A0 and D0. So if I take the cell body to go to zero It has zero efficiency, cannot swim. So it's bacterium, something perhaps I should have said earlier, bacterium cannot swim if it doesn't have a cell body. If I go back a couple of slides on the formula, if you look at this formula U, and you take the cell body to go to zero, if the cell body goes to zero, the resistance of the body goes to zero. The bottom formula is well defined, and the limit when A0 and D0 goes away, that's not going to zero, but the top goes to zero. So if I don't have a cell body, I cannot swim. There's something that's very different from bacterium compared to, for example, a sperm cell, that you need a cell body, and the reason why you need a cell body is because otherwise you have nothing to balance the moment. Now, that efficiency, turns out, also goes to zero if the body becomes too large. If my body becomes very, very large, here I have a naught, d naught at the top, but at the bottom, so I have a naught times a naught times d naught. So this is zero for very small cell body, but it's also very small efficiency for very large cell body, so there's an optimal. For whatever shape I give you, there's an optimal size of the cell body to maximize the efficiency. You can do this optimization, and you find that you lead to maximum possible efficiency, which is the intrinsic efficiency of your propeller. It only depends on the coefficients A, B, and D of my matrix. So this means that if I give you a helix, I can calculate A, B, and D, calculate the efficiency, and then do them for all the shapes. And we've done this. This was a work I done when I was in San Diego before I moved to Cambridge. And we've shown that the intrinsic efficiency, this is the intrinsic hydrodynamic efficiency of a flagellar filament, the best one of all the ones that exist is the one that they use for locomotion. It's 25% more efficient than any of the other ones in their arsenal that they have available for them for locomotion. And there are two ones that are the next best two ones, curly and semi-coiled, are ones I will talk about in a minute that are involved in the changes of directions of the cell. No, it doesn't change with the fluid, because if the fluid is Newtonian, those coefficients A, D, and B all scale with the viscosity of the fluid, so the viscosity goes away. So it basically changes with nothing but the geometry. It's assumed that it also doesn't change with the length, so it's really just a function of the hydrodynamics and basically the resistance and the geometry of the helix. Of course, if you take a helix that is not a helix, just a straight filament, doesn't have any efficiency. So here I plotted the efficiency as a function of the angle that the helix can do. So the angle could be zero if it's a straight rod. It could be 90 degrees if the helix is, has been squeezed into a circle. Of course, neither of these things are very efficient to swim. It's the best to be something in the middle. And so it peaks at where the normal helix is. Now, this is the best among all the shapes. What's even more remarkable, at least to me, is that if you then say, well, let's be not constrained by the shapes that exist in nature. Let's try, can I make something that's even better than the real normal shapes? So this is an isocontour of efficiency. So I'm imagining that I have a helix of a given material. I can plot this on, this is why I'm choosing the same type of plots that is used in that community, where they use the wavelength of the helix versus the circumference of the helix. Okay, so wavelength is here, circumference is this. And what I've shown is, so this black circle is where you should be if you are a kind of an E. coli. You're allowed to deform along that circle, geometrical circle. And the color scheme behind are the isocontours of the efficiency. I can, of course, build any helix I want, so I can vary those parameters continuously. And overlaid on top of this are the data. So see, the black are the experiments for E. coli. The red is the theory. Blue is all the types of flagella called polar flagella. They're slightly different because the monomer is a little bit different, but it's the same idea. So if I want to build the best optimal helix, if I'm E. coli, what I like to do is I like to be the intersection between that circle and the warm regions behind me. So where basically I'm the most orange. Okay, so see, I need to go right here. And look at what the best, look at the normal shape is. It's very, very close. It's just a few percent away. So not only it's the best among all the 11 shapes that exist, but it's also very close to being the best among all the shapes you could build if you were to just build an E. coli on a computer. Okay, so it's quite remarkable, purely from a fluid mechanics standpoint. Oh, yeah, okay, so here I'm measuring the wavelength as being negative if it's left-handed and positive if it's right-handed. This is, I'm referring you to these papers, which are in Biophysical Journal. This is how they map out all the geometry. This is just a notation convenience. Correct. So if I were to take a bacterium, well, if the hook is rigid and I have no coupling on the hook mechanics, which is, it is the case, but let's imagine I don't have to worry about the hook. If I rotate the bacterium, flagellar filaments one way, The cell body rotates the other way and it moves like this, and instantaneously, if I reverse, it will instantaneously go forward. A helix that is in front when it moves, this is a good one. A helix that is in front when it moves, I do not know of one, but I will need to think and then we'll tell answer on Friday maybe. That's a good one, I do not know the answer, I'm sorry. So maybe I don't. Maybe the answer is no, or at least I don't know. I don't know of one. Yeah, I'm going to talk about buckling in a minute, exactly for those reasons, absolutely. Good point, you already figured it out. Okay, now I will tell you about two more things. I have another 20 minutes. So an interesting thing about bacteria is how they explore the environment. They explore this environment. This is very classical. This is a classical paper of Howard Berg when they invented, or at least published, the invention of this tracking microscope, when they're able to follow bacteria as they explore the environment, and they found that the bacteria are doing those random walk motion. So they swim. This is the run phase. So this is deterministic swimming, kind of the way that I describe. And then there's a very quick event of reorientation, and then the cell goes in another direction, reorientation, another direction, reorientation. So it's a random walk. And here's the distribution that they published in that paper. Since then, it's been measured by other groups on the number of events, kind of basically the number of changes of direction as a function of, so these are numbers, and these are measuring the change of direction of the angle. So you can think of this as a probability distribution function for the change of angle. So it's been reproduced since then very well, and that's a very clear signature of what E. coli. And then E. coli, when they want to do chemotaxis, when they want to respond to chemical gradients, to go up or down chemical gradients, they essentially found a way, and I'm going to talk about this, to bias this random walk by changing the characteristics of the walk to be able to go up or down gradients. You can imagine very well that if you change the time or the length of multiple things have been studied theoretically, it turns out only one of them is what the bacterium does, which is extending its run a little bit when it's feeling good about where it's going, then you can bias this and go rectify basically the randomness and get a drift in addition to diffusion. Now it turns out what's interesting about this run and tumble motion from a physics point of view, in my opinion, is that it's really a mechanics problem. So the way cell, so I told you about the cell swimming. So I told you about what happens during most of the motion is this run phase. It swims, 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 and at some point the cell has decided chemically to change the direction. And the process in which it does this turns out all physics. So there's at least one of, so the cell is right here. So I start with one and I'm going to end up with eight, which is the exact same thing, but I've changed direction. So I need to figure out how I'm going from one to eight. The way I'm going from one to eight is at least one of the motors is going to change the direction of rotation, and that's going to eject one of the flagellar filament away from this bundle. As it's doing this, the flagellar filament is going to undergo, and this is the answer to your earlier question, a change in shape. So it used to be left-handed normal, now it's going to be right-handed semicoiled. So here's what it looks like. See, it looks different from this one on purpose. And that's going to disrupt the force and moment balance on the cell during this small interval of time. By the way, this is about a tenth of a second. That's going to kick the cell in a new direction. And at the end of this process, the motor returns to its rotation, the flagellar filaments rotate to its shape, and it goes back. That process is called unbundling, where you're kind of zipping a flagellar filament out of the bundle. And that process right here, the recovery, is called bundling, where, see, they have two filaments of different, hopefully this one is very clear, there's a very short, small wavelength and long wavelength filament, which are zipping back together at the end of this. That's the same process, but it changes some of the characteristics of what exactly the cell is doing and the angle by which it changes for every event. And this paper is the paper, this 2000 Journal of Bacteriology paper, that goes through the whole thing, that goes through doing all the measurements. This is the paper where they invented a method to stain fluorescently the flagellar filaments. This is why we're able to see this. And then they actually look at many hundreds of events, measure how many flagellar filaments are coming out, and measuring, the angles at which, this is a particular angle between those two filaments, one shape, one another shape. What is this angle? How does that affect the rotation? How does that affect the change? All of these things is tabulated. Very nice paper. But, ultimately, this is kind of mechanics and physics and fluid mechanics. So I've decided, with the postdoc, we decided to look at this and try to see, is it possible to understand this change of direction from a purely fluid mechanics standpoint, purely from, you know, I told you that the cell is changing direction because the flagellar filament is now in a new conformation at a different position, and therefore it's pushing and pulling on the cell in a different, at a different angle, in a different strength. If we describe this process purely geometrically and we apply fluid mechanics, are we able to reproduce what is seen in the experiment? So we built this. We basically went through the detail of this paper that I just described a minute ago, this 2000 paper. It's an amazing paper. And we went through, and if you you can extract, basically, from the kinematics of the filaments, you can extract exactly the three stages of the motion. You can describe exactly mathematically, you can build mathematical model for those three stages. Stage one is this unbundling phase, where I have a filament which leaves the, one of the filament is leaving, or more than one, is leaving this bundle, and so it's kind of being separated at some angle, fixed angle, from the original bundle, and at the same time it undergoes a kind of progressive conformation stage. Stage two, a shape. Stage two is when I have a bundle of one shape and then a filament pushing in another shape. And then stage three is the reverse of this, where I, it's not the reverse geometrically, because this one is unzipping from the bottom, where the top is still attached, whereas this one is the opposite, where it's the bottom is zipping back and it's the top that is not attached. Okay, so the unzipping starts from the bottom, whereas the zipping starts also from the bottom, which means that this is not the symmetric of this. So unbundling, semicoiling, bundling, and because we have those very precise measurements geometrically, we're able to geometrically describe what is going on. And if you put all of this together and you run this stochastically, then you get a distribution. This is the theoretical distribution that we predict. Well, theoretical, I should say computational. This is explained in this paper. So the Berg data are the purple dots, and the yellow one is a much more recent paper, Tao et al., Nature Communications, which reproduced this. And then the blue is our prediction. And we don't have to adjust parameters in this theory because the entire kinematic description, stage by stage, is actually taken from the experiment. So what we're doing, of course, we're not predicting what that shape is doing. What we're saying, if you know exactly the sequence of shapes and the geometry in which the cell is going, and you apply the principle of fluid mechanics, then it's all a consequence of fluid mechanics. We have not included that in the model, we have not included that in the model. Well, I'm sure they play some role, but you know, if you look at the distribution at the end, this was the big bet that we did, which is to say, let's try to see if we need hydrodynamic contractions or not. It will make the model much more complicated because we will need to do the computations will be much more taxing. The bundle, well, people have studied the hydrodynamics of bundles, how the bundle hydrodynamic is different from the hydrodynamics of a single filament. It only depends very weakly on the thickness, and we know exactly how it depends on the weakness. And so if we know in the thickness, if we know how many filaments, we can replace this by an effective radius because people have measured this in the lab. The points are not mine. The points are the experiment. Oh, because I drew, okay, yes, because I drew the angle, this angle theta, from a random uniform distribution. So I drew, I had to draw something stochastically, I had to draw the angle where the axis between the, well, basically that angle, which is, you have one shape here, another shape, and the orientation can be anything. So without any further knowledge, we draw this stochastically from a normal uniform distribution. This is the case where, well, I don't. We've done cases where 1 through 4 come out because this is. I have to admit. I think this is the one where 2 filaments come out, and basically they all basically look the same. I refer you to the paper. I don't have this in this slide, but there's basically no difference between them. Yes. So you're right. I have to draw one thing stochastically, and that's what I drew, which is that angle. Well, I don't know if you can see. There's a theta here, and that phi is anything I want. It doesn't vary. In fact, it doesn't matter what phi is. It's theta that matters, because obviously if I go theta pi, then those two things are pushing one another. If they're very close to one another, they're doing constructively, so that's the thing that I vary, yes. Well, it does vary, because if I pick a different theta, I'm going to have a different speed of the cell and a different orientation. But if I draw uniformly, I'm getting the consequence. This is the consequence on, this is, that angle is not that angle theta. That theta is something that I have a parameter in my model and I draw it from the distribution. What I measure is the angle, which is the angle between the previous direction of swimming and then the final direction of swimming. I wouldn't say it doesn't matter the value. If I do one realization with one angle, then I will get one angle of change on the tumble. Here I'm telling you that we've drawn statistically many, 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 many cases, and the angle theta is drawn uniformly. I guess that's the question you're asking. What can I interpret this? Why this angle here? Yes. I guess there is a physical interpretation because we know, I don't have the physical simple, I guess you're looking for something very simple. I wish I had the intuition. You know, all of what we're doing is geometry and force and moment balance. So there has to be a simple way to interpret this. Why is that thing coming from both the experiments and the theory peak at that point? And to me, it has to come from the difference in proportion. It has to be related intrinsically to the difference in proportion between this shape, which is this semi-chord shape, which is small wavelength, and that shape, which is a long wavelength shape. And we have not done the simulation with other shapes because we wanted to just reproduce the experiment, but I'm convinced that if you were to take a different shape here, then you would get a different angle. To me, it has to, because that's the only thing that really is in the model. And the rest is purely geometry of picking angles, but that's, you know, it's uniformly distributed. Rotational diffusion. Yes, I remember. There's a very nice plus one paper. I don't have this. I don't remember this. I don't remember.
Have a maximum in any case, because
yes, it would have a maximum. And in fact, I think they were able to fit this to some effective Brownian rotational diffusion. That's right. That's a good point. I should have included this. Yeah. So now I'm a little bit. I enjoy all these questions, but it means that I'm not squeezing the other half of my talk. No, I'm just kidding, not the other half. But I want to talk about a couple of things, at least one thing, which is this issue of there's a theme in mechanics called fluid structure instabilities. Of course, you know this from, fluttering in the wind, all these things. And they also turns out they also take place for bacteria. So these are some simulations. These are just simple elastic filaments. These are simulations of actual bistable helices. So helices are supposed to model a normal shape, a double well potential that would like to be either a normal or semi-coiled, and then you can do transition from one to the other. And if you rotate this fast enough, then you're going to get buckling. This is a nice calculation that we've done, computations, PRL, with buckling of the helical filament. You're going to have a buckling of the shape as well. These are experiments in PNAS where they've shown that if you have a bacterium that is stuck in a corner, then it will undergo an instability of the flagellar filament, or at least that's their hypothesis, to escape the corners, to wrap the cell so that the flagellar filament, which was behind, this was the normal swimming type conformation, will end up wrapping this around the cell and allow the cell to escape the corner. So it's another instability at the level of flagellar filament. There's something you said earlier about buckling. There's a famous exploitation of a mechanical instability for bacteria, and these are for bacteria that only have a single flagellar filament. So this run and tumble works because intrinsically, at least I have two filament, if not more, which means that I can actuate them independently. And that allows me to either be pushed or be pulled in one direction, or I can reorient. Now imagine I only have one. If I only have one, then if I rotate the direction the other way, then, it's just going to be rotated the other way, maybe going to go forward, go backward. It's not enough to change orientation. So bacteria that do this have exploited, so this was discovered only very recently, that they use the fact that the hook can buckle. So this hook is not just elastic, it's actually stiffens under force and torque, but you can exploit a small window during which this hook buckles to kind of randomly reorient yourself. So imagine you have a cell. This is the body. This is the flagellar filament. Imagine the flagellar, the helix is pulling. So this is would be an example. Now I have an example of the helix pulling on the cell for some time. Then the hook is under tension. It's not going to buckle unless it breaks. It doesn't break. So it's just going to pull the cell for a little bit. Just going to go forward. Then if you instantaneously change your direction or rotation, then the hook is becoming instantaneously under compression, which is would like make that the cell will go the other way, but that because the hook will buckle for a small window of time, see the green is when the cell is being pulled by the flagellum, and then when the cell is being pushed by the flagellum for a little bit of time, this is the red, it has a straight motion, almost reversing the green one. So of course, if you'd only be doing red, that would not be very efficient. You were just doing back and forth and back and forth, essentially. But here at this moment, the hook buckles. So the hook, this hook at that moment is under compression. And the window, they actually looked at the window of the amount of compression it gets in the time, and then you get buckling, and the cell is actually kind of, because it's buckling, it's an instability, the cell moves for a little bit of time, it reorients the cell for a small window, and then it does it again. And so this is a run-reverse type motion, where instead of using multiple flagellar filaments for reorientation, you're exploiting a mechanical instability for rotation. So recently, I've worked on a paper which was asking a question about, and that's what I'm going to finish on this. I only have 5 minutes, so I'm not going to show you the detail, but I want to tease out an interesting question, I think, which is to say, imagine I have a cell like E. coli. So E. coli, these are pictures of E. coli. We can see the flagellar filaments. They're coming out at different points around the cell body, sticking out randomly. Well, clearly, this is not a good conformation for swimming, because if they're all rotating and all pushing on the cell, they're all kind of interfering with one another, and you're not getting a very nice rotation together. It's all kind of destructively interfering. What you would like instead, you would like this conformation, where you've moved all the flagellar filaments on one side, and then they all together as a group push the cell in this direction. So why is it that this what I think perhaps could be thought of as a bad design, where you have all the motor randomly distributed, why doesn't that lead to random, almost averaging to zero amount of propulsion? And why instead are you getting this? Okay, so it turns out, so we've done simulation, and it turns out it's because it's an instability. So swimming for a bacterium can be thought of as an instability. So I'm not going to show you the detail. These are simulations we build. I'm going to skip this. I'm just going to show you. This is an example of a simulation for an E. coli that is swimming. It has four flagellar filaments. They're the same, different colors, but they're the same. And I'm starting the experiment, the numerical experiment, where I rotate the filament. The hook is flexible. And as the cell swims, because the hook is flexible, whatever initial amount of net locomotion you have, that's where the cell is going. But that means that in the frame of the cell, there's a flow that is backwards, which actually is going to end up wrapping all the flagellar. So it's kind of a self-sustained thing. And if the hook is flexible enough, you will end up in this conformation, which is the conformation where they all kind of constructively work together to push the cell. And what is very important about this process, this is the one message that you need to take away from this, is that, okay, I can do this if it's a cell and it's a very flexible hook. If the hook is very rigid, it's not going to do this. If the hook is rigid, it's not going to transition. The hook doesn't want the axis of the flagellar filament to go away from the preferred axis of the motor, so the cell is just going to keep whatever orientation you're giving it, and then it's going to move a little bit. It's moving a little bit because, of course, the forces are not exactly canceling out to zero, so there's a small amount of velocity, and it just moves very, very slowly. Now, if you were to take the same cell, and instead of having flagellar filaments which keeps pushing on the cell, instead, imagine the same, but they're all pulling on the cell, with the same hook, everything. So you make your cell that was a pusher, okay, that's the name you use to this, to a puller state. Well, a puller cell never swims. Whatever the hook stiffness, it never swims. So there's an instability. So here's the example, where kind of the simplest example of a cell body that has two flagellar filaments, which are symmetrically located on either side. Okay, this is the kind of the purest form of this instability. And if you have a puller, so that the flagellar filament is pulling on the cell on either side, whatever the hook stiffness, the conformation will always remain at zero, so that angle theta will always remain at zero with one filament here, one filament there. This is this conformation, and it will never swim. Whereas if you play with the hook stiffness in the pushing stage, there's an instability where if it's floppy enough, you undergo a dramatic instability as it swims. Okay? And so this is this, you know, we can do this an experiment using Jean-François. You know, we can take one person and me pulling on Jean-François with a piece of rope. We can pull as much as we want. We will never have an instability. But if instead we have a spear and I poke you, and somebody else is poking him from the side, and if I perturb him, then eventually there'll be an instability. In this case, it's coupled through the fluid. So swimming for those bacteria, even though you make them, if the hook is flexible enough, Doesn't matter how you generate the location of the motors, they will go undergo an instability and they will get in this conformation where all the flagellar filaments are wrapped behind the cell and the cell is moving forward. So we've studied, you can do this theoretically, you can predict this instability theoretically. I don't have time to go into detail because it's six already. But basically, this is a transition from this state, this pushing state at the stiff limit to this critical linear instability, the critical hook stiffness beyond which you do this. And in real life, they're about one order of magnitude stuffed enough. You know, if you calculate the theory, what it should be, they're about one order of magnitude softer than the critical value so that they're safely in the regime for the instability. No, they're fixed. They're fixed to where the motors are. So the motors
have a
fixed position. If you take multiple cells, they could be at completely different locations, but once they don't move around on the cell and they're not changing. It's not even buckling. The hook that we have is it's a feedback from the fluid flow to the cell. So the hook that we have in this model is not even a real beam that can buckle. It's simply a torsional spring. No hydraulic contraction. It's purely coupling through the cell. So the mechanism is, if I'm in my cell, which starts, you know, imagine I have this small conformation here at the very beginning. My cell starts to swim a little bit up. So if I go in the frame of the cell, that means that I have a kind of a viscous wind. And then, you know, I have to figure out, I have to solve this interaction problem. The cell is continuously to go up, and that wind, that flow, is actually acting to continuously push, to exert, to drag. So I have to solve this problem correctly, and it turns out there's an instability at a fixed hook. If the hook is very rigid, it comes back. It's all done in this paper. If the hook is really rigid, the rigidity of the hook just says that there's a torque. If theta is not zero, there's a torque. There is restoring torque. Very simple. So there's no buckling in this problem because the hook cannot even buckle. It's purely a fluid structure interaction problem. So to me, that's how I understand bacteria swimming. It doesn't matter the design, how poorly you want to put the motor everywhere. Suppose, as long as the hooks are soft enough, then it will always end up in this conformation. And that's where I think I'm going to stop, because that's the end. And that's it. Thank you very much.